Christopher Columbus. Who was Christopher Columbus? Christopher Columbus was a Genoese seaman who married into a seafaring family. His wife's grandfather had worked with Henry the Navigator himself, and Columbus's father-in-law had made a name for himself exploring the African coast. Like many Italians of his age, Columbus found work in Lisbon. That's where all the action was, Lisbon, Portugal, where he moved in 1470, sailing under the Portuguese flag, or, while stuck on land, selling charts and maps that he drew himself. Like his wife's father, Columbus had spent some time on Africa's Gold Coast, where he'd seen firsthand how Portuguese and Africans dealt in slaves, among other commodities, with one another. Did the Vikings influence Christopher Columbus? Columbus was less interested in rounding Africa to get to Asia than in crossing the Atlantic and going west for the same purpose. Like many of his contemporaries, not to mention the great thinkers of classical antiquity, he understood that the world was round, something every European university of his time taught, and every experienced seaman knew, and that at least in theory one could reach the east by sailing west. That belief may have been significantly buoyed up during the winter of 1477, when a young Columbus possibly stayed at an Icelandic farm, if the Genoese sailor was there. He certainly learned of the great western voyages of men like Eric the Red and Eric's son, Leif Erikson, and of their discoveries in Greenland and Vinland 5 centuries earlier. Modern scholarship casts some doubt on the idea that Columbus sailed to Iceland, a claim based on a single passage in the biography written by his son Ferdinand. But still, many scholars, especially in Scandinavia, continue to argue that Columbus did indeed spend a winter in Iceland. Another early video of mine sheds some light on the question of Viking inroads in America. Let's take a look. Let's go to Iceland. Keeping in mind, this isn't just one of my early videos, so there's going to be some wind sounds. This was an exceptionally windy Icelandic coastline. Here we go.
When you think of Iceland, I think you think of Vikings, and that's appropriate. The Iceland is, will become a Viking country, but at first, Iceland seems to have been settled by not the Vikings, but the Irish. Irish monks in particular. So if you were a monk in Egypt or in Syria, you could go off into the desert seeking isolation. But if you're in Ireland, you know, not too many deserts. So you go look for what they call the desert in the sea. You go, you make a wicker boat and you just head off and go wherever the Lord sends you. And some of these will land in Iceland. By the way, there are stories. Who knows if they're true? There are some who believe that the Irish, some of these Irish monks end up in North America as the first Europeans in North America, but we do know, though, that some of them will end up in Iceland. And when the first Vikings show up, they find Irish monks in Iceland. These guys will get written out of the sagas or they'll get pushed out, but the fact remains that some of the first settlers in Iceland, the first, perhaps, were Irish monks. The Vikings won't show up here in force until the late 800s. Really, there's a 60-year window there from about 870 to 930 where there's a major Viking land grab in Iceland. That 60-year period where all the best spots are taken by the Vikings who show up. And by the way, among the Vikings who show up during this first little bit here are Irish as well. Not monks this time, but captives, slaves, concubines. See, that's one of the things the Vikings did, is they kidnapped a lot of people. Vikings were mostly young men. I mean, these Viking means pirate. These guys were, for whatever reason, they were pushed out of Scandinavia, land scarcity, whatever it might be. They're looking for brides, they're looking for land and opportunity elsewhere. And as we know, they're going to show up all over the place. Europe and the edges of Asia, all over Northern Europe and the Baltic, all over the Atlantic coast, Spain. They're going to set up shop and set up a whole kingdom in southern Italy, North Africa, Constantinople, the Black Sea, and beyond, Russia. I mean, they're all over the place. And this is what they're looking for. So when they first show up in Iceland here, they have a bunch of these captives with them. They have a bunch of these Irish with them. Well, you have that 60-year period when all the best sites are taken, and then anyone who shows up afterwards is sort of out of luck. You gotta take subpar land, or you keep pushing west. Now, if you're a American student or a Western student, you've probably heard of Eric the Red. You've probably heard of Leif Erikson. These are names that may sound familiar in the context of the discovery of America for Europe, things like that. Well, as you dig into these people and put context behind them, you find they're probably a lot more interesting. So Eric the Red, for example. Eric the Red's father was a Norwegian Viking who becomes a fugitive. All we know is that he was a murderer, or there were several killings done at his hands, or at least alleged to have been done at his hands. So he has to flee Norway. Where does he flee? Right here. He flees to Iceland and sets up shop here. His son, probably a little bit like him, he ends up getting banished from Iceland for 3 years for murder, several killings done at his hands. And where does he go for those 3 years of banishment? Well, he pushes west looking for better land. This is what Vikings do. And he heads west, and he heads to a place he calls Greenland. Greenland. And he sets up a colony of several hundred there, and he becomes the chief colonizer of Greenland. It just so happens that a merchant, a trader named Bjarni Herjolfsson, looking to trade with this new colony of Greenland, he sails towards Greenland, but his boat, his ship, overshoots Greenland, and instead he lays eyes on what we now call North America, Bjarni Herjolfsson. He does end up in Greenland, and who ends up buying his ship years later, many years later? Eric the Red's son, Leif Erikson, ends up buying Bjarni Herjolfsson's ship, the same ship. And it's Leif Erikson that ends up making landfall in North America in a place called Vinland. We don't know where Vinland is, where Leif Erikson's campsite was, though a campsite has been found. A Viking campsite, we don't know if it's his, but Vinland could have been. I've read scholarship that places it on Prince Edward Island, Nova Scotia, New England, even as far south as Virginia, who knows. But in any case, he's there for a couple winters, I think. Ends up having to leave, mostly due to encounters with what the Vikings, or who the Vikings call Skraelings. Skraelings, the locals, the Native Americans, the American Indians. These are violent encounters. Sometimes the Vikings kill the Skraelings, sometimes the Skraelings kill the Vikings, but be that as it may, it is not profitable for Leif Erikson to be there any longer, and he ends up leaving. Eric the Red's family, Leif Erikson's family, they will continue to settle, or try to settle, North America, and most of this doesn't make it into the textbooks. Leif Erikson's brother will try to settle in America. Leif Erikson's brother-in-law will try to settle in Vinland, in this land. Eric the Red's illegitimate daughter will try to settle here. All will fail, mostly because of contact with the Skraelings, which turns violent in nature. I'm in Alexandria, Minnesota, where the famous Kensington Runestone is housed in a runestone museum. Kensington is a village not far from here. If authentic, the Kensington Runestone would prove that there was a Viking presence in the interior of North America, at least in the 1360s. The Kensington Runestone purports to be from the 1360s. Kensington Runestone is by no means the only runestone, or purported runestone, to be found in North America. And there are other artifacts too, iron artifacts, battle axe heads, other things that have been found that at least suggest that the Vikings were much more involved, at least as travelers and explorers in North America, than, you know, Leif Erikson and his family's attempts to settle one campsite in Vinland. Is the Kensington Runestone authentic? Well, do some research, you be the judge. It's interesting though, we give Columbus credit for discovering America, and for Europe at least, for the old world, and rightly so. He is a pivot, everything changes after Columbus. But would he have made the voyage without the Vikings, without Eric the Red, without Leif Erikson, without Bjarni Herjolfsson, without these guys? Would Christopher Columbus have made the voyage? They wrote down their experiences in their sagas, and Columbus, we know, studied these sagas and helped. It was one of the things that helped convince him that you could sail west, to reach Asia, that there is land there to be discovered, to be found. You can go that way. So the Vikings definitely need to be remembered for that reason. One more interesting note, Columbus sails in 1492. The Vikings from Greenland continue to collect timber in North America into the mid-1300s. So barely 150 years before Columbus changes everything, the Vikings are probably still using North America, visiting North America, cutting down trees in North America, all the way up to that point. It was sort of an interesting little tidbit. Who discovered America? Who knows? In fact, there are some scholars who believe that it wasn't the Vikings or Columbus, but in terms of discovering America for Europe, it was Irish monks. Irish monks on their wicker boats sort of crash landing into North America. You be the judge.
Perhaps, then, knowledge of Viking voyages that took place hundreds of years before Columbus helped convince the young navigator that one could sail west and reach Asia. How did Columbus get Spain's backing for his expedition? 8 years after his alleged Iceland experience, in 1485, Columbus approached the King of Portugal with his idea. The proposal fell flat. Not only did the king's court mathematicians correctly point out that he'd have to sail at least 10,000 nautical miles to reach Cipangu, or Japan, Columbus argued the distance was only 2,400 miles, but the Portuguese court was already all in on the sail around Africa approach, which seemed especially promising at that very moment, as Portuguese explorers had recently discovered the Congo. Rejected, Columbus pitched his idea to several other monarchs or princes, including Ferdinand and Isabella, but none would sponsor his proposed venture. For the Spaniards' part, they were at that time in the midst of a costly crusade against the Moors of Granada, the Muslims. The last Muslim holdout was Granada on the Iberian Peninsula. So they're busy there. It's very expensive. That's what's taking up their time. They're often on the scene. Still, they kept Columbus around and even paid his living expenses for several years. Clearly, there was some interest there, but the timing wasn't right. In 1492, he decided to give the Catholic monarchs another try. In the court of Ferdinand and Isabella, Columbus explained his idea, again, and offered to carry out his expedition under the auspices of Spain. Now the timing was perfect. Granada had just fallen. With the Spanish victory came war booty, the confiscated property of vanquished Muslims and Jews, especially. Flush with newly won wealth, Isabella yet turned Columbus away again. His plan now was to try the King of France. But she called him back a few hours later after some of his supporters at court convinced her to give him another hearing. In the end, the Catholic monarchs did agree to sponsor Christopher Columbus's expedition, despite what must have seemed enormous risk. A deal was struck. So what was the deal? Well, the deal was, for the Catholic monarchs, they were to gain sovereignty over any new territories Columbus might discover. Should he be successful, Spain might even overtake Portugal in the race to control Asian trade with Europe. For Christopher Columbus, he was granted hereditary titles, Admiral of the Ocean Sea, Viceroy of the Indies, and he was promised that he could be governor of all the lands he might discover, in the Catholic monarch's name, of course. In addition, he was to personally retain a generous 1/10 of all riches acquired as a result of the expedition. Several Spanish seaports were ordered to help outfit Columbus, and he was granted a loan by the monarchs, too. Was Columbus's idea really that far-fetched? To answer this question, let's head to the Caribbean, to Puerto Rico.
Columbus's voyage was filled with uncertainty. Filled with uncertainty. He brought with him letters of introduction, but most of them were blank. They were addressed to no one because he had no idea who he'd be meeting. It was a fill-in-the-blank situation. And one letter was addressed to the Great Khan. He brought with him a translator, an educated Jew. This guy could speak fluent Arabic. Arabic, not Chinese, not Japanese, not some Indian language, nothing that could have been spoken on the Indonesian archipelago or in the Philippines. Arabic. Not a terrible choice. There were Muslims all over the world. But East Asia, not that many. It shows you the limited resources that Columbus had at his disposal. And though Columbus had been right about the 28th parallel north, that was his plan, sail along that 28th parallel north, that latitude, and eventually you'll hit Japanese waters, Sipangu, according to Marco Polo. That was correct. Of course, he didn't know a continent was in the way. However, he grossly underestimated the size of the Earth. You know, a more able geographer would have been able to tell him, and there were more able geographers in his day that could have told him this, probably did tell him this, that it would take like a 10,000 mile trip sailing through the open sea to get from Europe to Asia going west. 10,000 miles on the open sea. Now that is a dizzying prospect to the sailors of Columbus's day. Something like venturing out into open space on your way to Mars today.
How did Columbus's first voyage turn out? On August 3rd, 1492, Columbus's expedition set out. He commanded 87 men, all sailors, no priests, no soldiers, since Columbus only wanted experienced seamen, on three ships, two Portuguese caravels, the Niña and the Pinta, plus a larger ship, a carrack, or the precursor to the 17th century galleon, called the Santa Maria. After a frustrating month in the Canary Islands undergoing repairs, followed by more than a month on the open sea, land was finally sighted, the white cliffs of a small island in the Bahamas that Columbus would name San Salvador, meaning Holy Savior. Wading ashore, the Genoese sailor fell to his knees in the sand, glad to have escaped mutiny, and assuming he'd reached Japan. The natives of the island, the Taino, an Arawak people, were friendly, but they didn't seem like the inhabitants of a rich and powerful civilization. Columbus noted that they were naked, some with paint on their bodies, with little to offer in terms of material goods, though the women seemed to offer their bodies freely to the European newcomers. Though the island and surrounding islands were beautiful, there didn't seem to be much here of economic importance. As challenging as communication with the locals was, the Taino were able to indicate to Columbus that bigger islands to the south were filled with gold. The expedition set sail. To the south, Columbus came upon the island of Colba, later bastardized by the Spanish into Cuba. But after a little exploration, it was clear that this still wasn't Japan, and there wasn't much gold here either, though the natives did smoke a rolled leaf they called tobacos, which the Spanish ultimately introduced to Europe, with world-changing consequence. The locals, also Arawaks, warned the Spaniards that other peoples they might encounter, notably the Caribs, were dangerous cannibals who ate roasted human flesh. Continuing west, Columbus found a great island that reminded him of Spain, so he named it La Isla Española, the Spanish island, later shortened to Hispaniola. This was the future Haiti and Dominican Republic. Here the people wore gold ornaments in abundance, and the presence of a king-like figure, a chief named Guacanagarix, actually just one of at least five chiefs on Hispaniola, helped convince Columbus that he was getting closer to Japan. The admiral, as Columbus was called, likely would have kept going, but the Santa Maria was wrecked on a reef, and Columbus took it as a sign that he should establish a colony on Hispaniola. Using wood salvaged from the Santa Maria wreck, construction of Spain's most distant outpost began. Columbus called it Navidad. On January 4, 1493, Columbus began his return voyage to Spain aboard the Niña, leaving 21 volunteers behind to continue developing the colony. By April, he had presented himself to the Catholic monarchs, six Caribbean natives in tow, bearing brightly colored parrots in cages. He gloried in the discovery of the Indies, as he called them, the Indies, and together with the Catholic monarchs made plans for the establishment of regular trade between Asia and Spain. The King of Portugal, meanwhile, whom Columbus had met again while temporarily docked at Lisbon, was horrified and not a little jealous. It seemed that Spain's gamble had paid off. Ferdinand and Isabella had outsmarted the Portuguese and reached Asia first. This, by the way, was the historical context of the aforementioned Treaty of Tordesillas, drawn up and ratified by both parties by 1494. What happened to Columbus? When Columbus returned to Hispaniola in late 1493, now with 1,500 men and 17 ships, he found Navidad destroyed by the natives. All the men who'd stayed behind had been killed. It seems at least some of those men had raped a number of local women, and the locals had taken their revenge. The destruction of Navidad foreshadowed decades, even centuries, of cross-cultural misunderstandings that too often ended in blood. A new colony was established, Isabela, and fresh exploration undertaken. New islands began to be mapped, notably Jamaica. Overland expeditions were sent into Hispaniola in search of the natives' source of gold, and hundreds of natives were now captured and turned into slaves. The locals rose up in rebellion, but their attacks on Isabela were repelled by Spanish guns and Spanish dogs. The first shipment of 500 Taino slaves from the Indies to Spain saw 200 of them die of exposure on the way over, and most of the rest die of disease shortly after their European arrival. Meanwhile, the colonizing Spaniards themselves began to divide against one another, and especially against the government of Columbus's brother, Diego, whom he'd put in charge at Isabela. Some, returning to Spain from Hispaniola, complained against Columbus at court. Their reports made Hispaniola out to be something of a bust. No contact had been made with the great rulers of Japan or China. No great source of gold had been found. No valuable trade routes had been established. And the island was brimming with rebellion, both native and Spanish. And the Columbus brothers were being charged with severe mismanagement. To this could be added Isabella's displeasure that Columbus had mistreated and enslaved the natives, something she had expressly forbidden him to do. She'd even ordered the release of those American Indians he'd brought back to Spain after his first voyage. By enslaving the natives, by the way, Columbus was acting according to a long-held European tradition of enslaving non-Christian war captives. Ferdinand and Isabella themselves had done likewise during the Reconquista on the Iberian Peninsula, but the Christianizing of the American Indians was clearly possible, and thus Isabella wrestled with the morality of enslaving or otherwise mistreating them. These questions tormented her to the day of her death in 1504. But the Portuguese were at that very moment outfitting one Vasco da Gama, who was hoping to sail all the way to India by sea around Africa. Perhaps this is why, when Columbus returned to Spain in 1496 to defend himself against his detractors, the Catholic monarchs allowed him to retain his position vis-a-vis the newly discovered Western territories. A third Columbus-led expedition set out from Spain in 1498. This time, Columbus actually laid eyes on the Venezuelan coastline, in other words, on the American mainland. But upon reaching Hispaniola again, Columbus found that the colony his other brother, Bartholomew, had set up, Santo Domingo, was as divided as Isabella had been. The Spanish colonists were still suspicious of and often hostile to Columbus and his brothers. They're seen as these Italian foreign overlords. Columbus tried to reach a compromise with the rebels, but failed. In 1500, a royal official was dispatched to the Indies from Spain to investigate. Ultimately, Columbus was sent back to Spain in chains, humiliated. No longer would the great Genoese explorer be viceroy of the Indies. Making it official, in 1502, the Catholic monarchs sent a royal governor, Nicolás de Ovando, to administer the region instead. Now, Columbus still had one great voyage in him. The same year that Ovando was sent to govern what would soon be called the Spanish Indies, Christopher Columbus was outfitted for a fourth expedition. His quest, as always, was to find a direct sea route to Asia. In the process, he mapped the coastline of much of Central America, including what we call Panama, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Costa Rica. But when he died in 1506, Christopher Columbus was still convinced he had discovered islands and peninsulas off of East Asia. What one scholar said, in this case Lawrence Bergreen, in the book Columbus, the Four Voyages. Quote, "The drastic devaluation of Columbus seems a recent phenomenon, but it originated at the time of his voyages. The Spanish judicial investigator Francisco de Bobadilla sent him home in chains. King Ferdinand disdained him. Bishop Fonseca's intense dislike for Columbus was widely known. Amerigo Vespucci fostered the impression that he, rather than Columbus, had discovered a new world and gave his name to the continent. His former lieutenant, Alonso de Ojeda, laid claim to territories first visited by Columbus. Nicolás de Ovando, who succeeded Columbus as governor of Hispaniola, endangered his life and mocked him. The Porras brothers, Francisco Roldán, and others who sailed with Columbus staged mutinies with little or no retribution. For all the scorn Columbus engendered, his four voyages constitute one of the greatest adventure stories in history. Although he was not the first explorer to glimpse or visit the distant shores of the Americas, his was the discovery that permanently planted the reality of a new world in the imagination and political schemes of the old. Columbus forever changed the idea of what a European empire could be. He had the vision, and at times the delusion, to imagine and to persuade himself and others that he had found something immense, important, and lasting. End quote. In sum, Christopher Columbus was a Genoese navigator who moved to Portugal to make his way as a seafarer in the Atlantic. For years, he peddled his idea for a westward expedition to Asia, possibly buoyed by a winter spent in Iceland, where he may have studied the Viking sagas, to multiple monarchs and princes before the fall of Granada finally allowed Ferdinand and Isabella to sponsor his plan. Columbus discovered and initiated the colonization of many Caribbean islands, laid eyes on the American mainland, and mapped critical coastlines. European contact with the Taino led quickly to conflict and the enslavement of part of the native population. In the end, though Columbus was humiliated for a time and demoted, his voyages ushered in a new era in world history by permanently introducing the Americas to Afro-Eurasia.